Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film and maybe one that influenced their own work. Today, I'm very excited to have on the show Chief Creative Officer of MWM Studios, Rachel Shane. Hi, Rachel.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing great. And how are you, Rachel?
I am doing amazing.
For those of you who are unfamiliar with Rachel's work, please let me give you an introduction. Before MWM, Rachel was EVP of production for Red Wagon Entertainment, where she was an EP on Divergent and Lawless. And now Rachel oversees all aspects of feature film and television development and production for MWM, formerly known as Oddlot. Most recently, Rachel was executive producer on the 10-time Emmy-nominated series Genius. That was National Geographic's first ever scripted television series, and the first season followed the life of Albert Einstein, with Jeffrey Rush playing the older Einstein. And the upcoming season that will follow the life of Pablo Picasso, which will be played by Antonio Banderas. But also, I just heard that there is another season, the third season, which will be Mary Shelley, which
I'm very
excited about.
Yes.
Rachel was also executive producer on the Academy Award nominated film Hell or High Water, starring Jeff Bridges, Chris Pine, and Ben Foster. And she served as an executive producer on Landline, which was written by Obvious Child's Gillian Robespierre and starred Jenny Slate, John Turturro, and Edie Falco. Listeners of the show are very familiar with Gillian Robespierre, I believe. MWM has a bunch of new projects on the slate. Rachel will be working on, and they just acquired the rights to Code of Silence, I believe. It's about a female whistleblower inside the Chicago Police Department, and Rebecca Miller's got a feature with you guys called She Came to Me, and that's something I'm anxiously awaiting because I love Rebecca Miller. Dear God, I want her on the show as well. Rachel, today you chose to speak about a movie that is very beloved to me, and it is David Cronenberg's The Fly. Can you tell me a little bit about why you selected that as one of your fave genre films?
You know, I think that as a younger person, when I originally saw the film, it left this unbelievable imprint in my mind in terms of its grotesque nature.
Certainly.
It was probably one of the first times that I'd seen anything so gory on screen before. Mm-hmm. I was also a teenager, a young teenager, and that transformative process that Jeff Goldblum goes through probably subconsciously was, you know, somehow related to my own bodily changes and transformation. I think in addition to that, I know that this was not necessarily Cronenberg's intention, but the AIDS epidemic was a massive thing at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had a personal connection to it with a dance teacher. And so I think that also kind of, you know, again, fed into it. But from a filmic place, the fact that Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum's characters were real human beings connecting at this very inopportune time. And, you know, the Beauty and the Beast element to it. And, you know, I was rewatching it recently. Even there's some actual imagery from Shape of Water that reminded me of some of the stuff some of the visuals in The Fly, which was very interesting to see in that monster movie. But I also think the camp of it is just so much fun to watch in general. So there's a lot about it that has left a lasting impression.
Yeah, it rides an interesting line of humor and drama and tragedy in a way that I think not many films can accomplish. But it's definitely one that's lasted in my mind as well.
Mm-hmm.
For those who are unfamiliar with The Fly, they haven't seen The Fly yet, why not? Today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause this podcast now and watch The Fly, this is your time. And now you're back. So I'm going to give a little rundown of The Fly, a synopsis. Written by Charles Edward Pogue and David Cronenberg and directed by Cronenberg in 1986, The Fly stars Jeff Goldblum as Seth Brundle, a renegade scientist who's almost perfected teleportation. He brings reporter Veronica Quaife. Is that how you say her last name? Quaife? That's an interesting name. Veronica Quaife, played by Gina Davis, back to his apartment to show her. And Veronica wants to write a story about Brundle's work and teleportation. She presents it to her editor and her ex, Stathis Borens, played by John Getz, to see what he thinks. And Stathis thinks that Brundle is basically a charlatan. Veronica is still begins documenting Brundle's life so she can write a book about him and break his discovery to the world, making both of their careers. In the process, they also fall in love. Brundle has a few pretty gross, unsuccessful attempts at teleporting animals, some inside-out animals specifically, but he finally succeeds when he teleports a baboon. So Brundle wants to celebrate, but Veronica gets a package from Stathis delivered, and she has to go and talk to him and set him straight that she doesn't want to work with him anymore. In the meantime, Brundle puts together that Stathis and Veronica's ex gets really drunk and sad and teleports himself with the monkey's help. Only problem is that a fly gets into the teleportation chamber with him, and Brundle starts feeling pretty good and buzzy after all of this, and he's talking a mile a minute, he's doing a bunch of gymnastics randomly, and it freaks Veronica out. Because maybe his teleportation wasn't so successful after all. Eventually, Brundle starts walking on the walls and turning into a fly and breaking dudes' arms at bars. And Veronica's had enough. He's turning into a fly and she's pregnant with his baby. And things get pretty weird and very disgusting. So that's The Fly in a nutshell. First off, this is a movie that seems to be... I you know, when you watch like the behind the scenes stuff, it seemed almost to be cursed from the beginning. It was riddled with problems, but somehow it came together to become a classic. So I definitely want to talk to you about what it means to usher a problem child like this through a production. But first, I wanted to talk about Jeff Goldblum. What a phenomenal performance in this movie. I cannot imagine a different actor in this role. Are you a Jeff Goldblum fan?
I have to say I am. I am. And he does give this really exuberant, innocent, geeky, but beautiful performance before he transforms. And then once he does transform, his presence and performance is so powerful that it emerges through the makeup and the prosthetics. And he doesn't get buried underneath it all. I think that's very rare, actually, to see that happen.
It's definitely a physical performance, like you were saying. And I know that on the set, he, once they started shooting, he started working out constantly because he wanted to like portray like the strength. So his body was literally transforming as they were shooting because he was building up muscle and he was like drinking tons of caffeine towards the later transformation. He was like all buzzed up. So he was on what he called it juice. but I find it fascinating that the only person who really absolutely wanted Jeff Goldblum for the part was David Cronenberg. Because the producers were kind of into it. They liked Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where he was also an amazing performer. But everyone else had qualms. And then Cronenberg had even asked his special effects guy, Chris Wallace, what he should look for physically in the lead. And he was like, no big nose, no big ears. And then Cronenberg had come back to him and was like, okay, we have an actor who has very large ears, a very large nose. I mean, there's nothing about this role that should have been, like, his for the taking, but it was his.
Completely. I think without him, I don't know what The Fly would be. I think the fact that he had these really strong features and was incredibly tall and kind of gangly was that much more interesting to see the transformation. Just because he is such a stark figure in terms of his looks.
And then later on, there's that the beautiful lighting when he is kind of growing into the strength of the fly but hasn't transformed, you know, physically into it. And you have the light streaming through the windows of that apartment, just like his oiled pecs. It's like shocking, you know, because he's such a nerd. But then all of a sudden you see him like with his shirt off and you're like, this guy is...
Gina Davis knew what was up.
One of the people who really did not think that he should be cast was Larry Gordon at Fox. He said, quote, "It's a horrible mistake, but it's your mistake to make. And if you want to go down that road and commit to this actor, you go and do it." Stuart Kornfeld, one of the producers of the film, said that that was one of the bravest things that he had ever seen a studio guy do. Fundamentally disagree with a filmmaker, but also let the filmmaker take the risk anyway. And I mean, it's a great payoff, obviously, because Goldblum was the right person for this. But in your experience, mm-hmm. you know, is it possible to do that?
Yes.
What happens? Like, how?
You know, I think depends what. I mean, the times are different now in terms of studios and risks that studios are willing to take. So I can't, and I don't work at a studio or run a studio, so I can't really speak towards that. But as a producer and as a financier, I think you have a lot more freedom to take risk and to also really have faith in your filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is that relationship. Between the producer and the filmmaker, or the financier and the filmmaker, to understand the point of view, why your director or the director believes that this will be the perfect choice, and go with it. And we've done that in the past. I've done that in the past, and it's scary, but it's fun, and they are usually right.
Can you give an example of, you know, a director who had a vision of like what they thought, and you guys sat down and you're like, yeah, okay.
So this wasn't an exact comparable example because I and the other producers and the financier mm-hmm. Of the film wanted this director, this actor as much as the director, but it was Tom Hardy on Lawless, and we mm-hmm. were all incredibly excited for him to come in and have a role in the film. And in the first couple of days of his performance, he was doing all of these kind of weird things and grunts. And
it's Tom Hardy, yeah.
But this was before anyone knew Tom Hardy.
Yeah,
And we all were just kind of looking at each other and, you know, had some sidebars with the director, like, what is this? Like, what's going on here? And John Hillcoat, to his credit, was like, let him do his thing. You know, he's doing his thing. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, you know, Tom's brilliant and was able to kind of think way beyond any of us. And he put together this performance that was unbelievable, where at the very start of it, you know, as lesser beings, we're scratching our heads. So, so it's about having faith in not only your filmmakers, but your actors too.
It's so scary. I mean, especially if you're on the producer's role, because you have to think about money. You know, the producers that we've had on the show, it is like balancing creativity with the return of investment.
Yeah.
And that seems to be, is that always hanging over your head? Do you have nightmares about it?
No, I don't. But, you know, it's hard when you're working with a foreign finance model
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you have that short list of actors or actresses.
And you can say, like, what's a foreign finance model?
So basically, it's pre-selling your foreign territories so that you can know that you have a certain amount of money that can be contributed to the budget to offset your budget.
So going into like China and being like, okay, we're going to sell this movie here and we know that we can get this amount of money at least. So
exactly. Although China is not always the easiest place to sell.
But, so maybe the worst example.
Like France or the UK or whatever that may be. But, you know, there's that short list of actors that are usually a couple years behind, and it's, you're working with your foreign sales agent and they're kind of dictating a lot of that. And that's where things get very tricky, where you have to be able to balance the risk that you feel you can take and belief that this actor is going to mm-hmm. work in other markets or domestically in a way that, you know, the foreign market may not. And it's a tricky balance.
We're going to take a quick break, but then I'm going to come back and I would love to talk to you about developing scripts and what that process is, because there's some fun stuff about how The Fly was developed too. So one quick break and we'll be right back.
It's been a long time coming, but John Roderick finally has a podcast on the MaximumFun.org network.
The long wait is over. Max Fun Friends, I teamed up with these two unlikely nerds and their dumb Star Trek podcast. And we talk about war movies, not just in a laudatory and salivating way, but we apply critical thinking principles to the multiple subtexts that are woven in every war movie.
And Sylvester Stallone specifically.
It is not that. It is not that at all.
So go grab Friendly Fire every Friday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here talking today to Rachel Shane about the movie The Fly. Okay, so let's talk about developing scripts, because I feel like that's kind of a lot of your job, I would assume.
It is.
So The Fly, both the original 1958 film and then this one, they were both based on a short story in Playboy that Fox had bought, right? Mm-hmm. Very different movies. You know, if you haven't seen the original with Vincent Price, like, get to it. Go and see it. Some of the lines that they have to deliver, they're just like kind of choking laughter because they're so ridiculous.
That's the definition of camp.
Oh, God, it's so good. Pogue, when he was writing his draft, he had never seen the original before he got the go-ahead to write his version. But he knew he wanted to stay away from the original's themes about a woman going mad. Like, that wasn't what he wanted, which I'm grateful for, because the original features the line,
"She changed her mind. You know how women are."
Which is the 50s. It's, you know. And Pogue also wanted to get away from some of the dicey science of the original one, like how the little fly gets the little human head and then the human gets the big fly head for some reason. None of it made sense. So, and Cronenberg, you know, he's really into science in all of his films.
Yes.
Everything up until this point, you know, you've got Scanners, The Brood, everything has kind of a scientific, psychological element to it. And so I appreciate that there seemed like some kind of interesting, inventive science that was going on instead of just the camp.
Right.
But it was a complete reimagining of an idea. Have you worked on projects like this where you take an old property and you try to make it new? I feel like that's something that's happening a lot right now. Is that expected of you as a producer?
You know, in my past and currently, I'm involved with a lot of book adaptations. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I'm very familiar with. Divergent was a book. Mm-hmm. Lawless was a book called The Whitest County in the World. There's a lot that I've been involved with that is based, I mean, it was a biography, but Einstein, Walter Isaacson's biography of Einstein is what the 10-part limited series was based on. So there's that. As far as I can recall, I don't think I've necessarily produced a film that was based on an older original movie, although while I was at Red Wagon, there were movies made and definitely development based on some older films. And, you know, there's a lot that, especially for books, I mean, there's a book that we're about to start getting into and we'll be announcing soon, but it's set in the 60s in China.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to adapt. And unless you're setting it in that period of time, and even if you are, you still have to look at what's relevant to today and how our audience is going to be able to process and understand.
So is that your first themes thing? When you look at an adaptation, you're like, what themes can we pull out that feel relevant to today? Is that the number one thing?
I mean, the number one thing when I look at something is just my emotional reaction and connection to it.
Yeah.
And how is this personally moving me to some emotion that's cathartic or revelatory, you know, tragic, romantic, whatever that really, you know, powerful emotion is. And then I have to take a next step as, okay, well, what is this really about? You know, who cares? Why do we care? Why do we need to tell this story right now? Mm-hmm. Why is it important? Who's going to see it? And so those are some of the things that I look at when I'm looking at source material. And it's really interesting to see just how relevant certain things are still. Mm-hmm. And they hold up. But yeah, I would say that in terms of adaptation, the primary thing that I've been involved with is the novel.
When you were working on, for instance, Einstein, when you read the book that it was, you know, loosely based on, what was it about that said to you, this is a story that needs to be told now?
Well, when I arrived at MWM Studios, which was then called Oddlot Entertainment, a couple of years ago, Gigi Pritzker, whose company it is, was, mm-hmm. had already bought, along with another company, the rights to the book. So we had Walter's biography, and her intention was to develop it for film. Mm-hmm. When I got there, we were talking more about how we were going to actually do this, because there was so much information, so many stories to be told about Einstein's life, that it felt like you were kind of, you know, robbing the narrative by just telling it in 2 hours. So we decided to adapt it for TV and look at it in a 10-part series so that you could cover a lot more ground. And mm-hmm. the executive under me, who was a CE at the time, Melissa Rucker, found this writer, Noah Pink, who's a young writer, hadn't really written TV before, and he came in with a great framing device of how to kind of like connect all of the stories together, in stories, you know, the different chapters of Einstein's life.
Yeah.
And so through that, he was able to write a pilot and a great Bible, and then we as a company with Noah went and brought it to Ron Howard. And so Ron came on board, and from then on, we, you know, just kind of took off.
There, I mean, one thing that I was really appreciative was that your Einstein series also mentioned his first wife, who was very influential in his life, which for me kind of seemed to correct a record of who this person was.
Yeah.
So if I'm thinking about why now, that's...
Oh, for sure. And, you know, he had a very complicated relationship with the women in his life, divorcing. In the divorce of his first wife, he promised her his Nobel Prize funds. So it definitely shed a light onto the brilliance and the sacrifice of this woman.
I want to talk about the script of The Fly too, like getting into the nitty gritty of like what these drafts do, because I think, you know, a lot of people don't understand how many drafts a script will go mm-hmm. through before it even gets, you know, to production. And then even then you have to do some rewrites. So Cronenberg, his rewrite of the script, he had demanded, I think, like $750,000 to write and direct. And everyone was over a barrel because the project was, you know, falling through at multiple stages, and they were like, we actually need this person, and it's the only way that this movie can be made. So they're like, yeah. So he got the script and he did a rewrite on it too. And I feel like you can absolutely see his touch on the script, specifically even in the first 10 pages. Everything that I've noticed about Cronenberg's movies is that he really takes that kind of writing rule of starting in a scene, in the middle of a scene, in medias res, very literally. So for The Fly, you know, we start while Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis are basically in a conversation that's ending.
What am I working on? I'm working on something that'll change the world and human life as we know it.
Change it a lot or just a bit? You'll have to be more specific.
What, do you want me to be specific here in this room with half the scientific community of North America eavesdropping?
Is there another way?
You could come back to my lab. Listen, I'll make a cappuccino. I have a Fiamma of my very own. You know what that is? It's not the dilettante's plastic kitchen model. It's one of those a real restaurant espresso machines with an eagle on top. And...
somehow I get the feeling you don't get out much.
You can tell that?
Yeah.
When you were rewatching it, did you remember how that began?
No. I mean, all I remembered was, you know, grotesque, disgusting ooze coming out of Jeff Goldblum's mouth.
Right.
And dissolving things. But no, I did not remember that. And that in rewatching it, it was really striking just to be thrown into that scene, not really knowing where you were, who these people were, but instantly he was able to communicate that so efficiently. And yeah, I think he has efficiency is a great word to describe how he, I guess, writes. I believe that was his opening and not the original writers.
Something about that opening, though, it totally inspires me to want to, you know, like, I think we get so hung up in having to explain things. And I think in a different writer's hands, there would have been a lot of more explaining about science. But there's also something to be said about just letting people figure it out.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And it's interesting. I was having this conversation yesterday with Rebecca Miller, actually, talking about TV versus film and how with film, there has to be, I believe, even more specificity in terms of your wardrobe and your production design, even though there's amazing stuff going on in TV now, just because so much more of a filmic lens is being lent to it.
Yeah.
But you have such a short amount of time to convey who these people are, why they're there, where they are, why they're doing what they're doing, that everything has to contribute to telling your narrative. And, you know, it was interesting just to think about it, that in as it relates to this scene that you're talking about.
So we had mentioned this before. Script is that king or is it just idea? Because I think about how Chris Wallace wasn't even going to do this project at all because he had seen that it was going to be a remake of the 1958 movie. And he was like, no, I'm not interested in that. That could be bad for my career. But then he read the script that Cronenberg had written. He was just like, oh, my God, this is amazing. I have to be a part of this.
Yeah.
You know, is it the words that can pull everyone together or is it, you know, just the director? Is it the idea?
I think the director has a huge piece of it, is a huge piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, everyone's searching for that beautiful, poignant, shocking, fresh piece of material that nobody's read or seen before. And once that's in someone's hands, it's power. And you have the ability to attract terrific performers, terrific directors, crew. And that is the guiding light. And, you know, I've been lucky to be in that position before. And it's super fun because instead of you having to, like, call every single agent and beg for them just to like answer the phone, you have the actors themselves, you know, begging to come and sit down and meet. And it's
when has that happened for you?
That happened on Lawless, actually.
Ooh.
Yeah. Those roles were so great. Those characters were so, so terrific as written in the script.
And it just kind of gets out to agents that like this, there's a script, there's like this, these roles that are really meaty for people and people
start
calling
for it.
Yeah, I mean,
basically, once a script's out there, everyone has it in this day and age, unless you print it on red paper and, you know, have people read it in a vault. It's, and I'm not joking because that does happen, but.
Oh my God. I mean, I'm assuming like probably Marvel or.
Yeah. That kind of thing. So, but otherwise, there's nothing sacred anymore.
We are going to take another quick break and then I'm going to come back and I want to get into some of the special effects stuff and talk about like our favorite scenes, those bits and how scary it might be as a producer taking on something that's going to have a lot of complex set pieces. Because to me that seems like it would be very scary. So one quick break and we'll be right back.
Thank you. Following the news is hard and it sucks.
How do you know which stories are important?
Which sources do you trust in this post-truth world of reactionary journalism?
I'm Brett Black.
And I'm Travis McElroy.
And we host a podcast called Trends Like These.
We cover trending news stories.
We debunk misleading clickbait headlines.
And we always try to throw in a little bit of good news.
In our quest for truth!
So join us every week on MaximumFun.org or wherever podcasts are found.
And welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here talking today to producer Rachel Shane. Hi.
Hello.
We're embroiled in a conversation about The Fly, and so I would like to talk about some special effects things because, I mean, obviously, that's what you were saying before. That's the thing that you remember, you know? We can go back in our brains and be like, oh, my God, the writing of this film is amazing. But we remember Jeff Goldblum regurgitating things on John Getz's leg first, right?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, that's obviously. And
the fingernails. Let's not forget the fingernails.
What is it? Something about eyeballs and fingernails that really freak people out, too. So I'm glad that they didn't do the eyeballs. But the fingernails still, it's like something about like thinking that your nail is going to fall off.
I think it's kind of like it's going down a really unsavory path, but it's almost like it's your shell, it's your safety boundary from the outside world, and it's like if your skin's coming off, and I think that's also just how the first experiment becomes this inside out animal. It's just, you know, your insides are being exposed in some way, and that I think that there's some kind of subconscious thing that's going on with that,
like an emotion. Yeah, I think there's kind of a dream logic to this, the emotional thing. When you were talking about relating to this in a way because of the AIDS epidemic, too, like that is something that I hadn't thought about. But it did overlap with this. And there are these kinds of things about like what if your insides become outside of you?
Yeah. Yeah. And I know that I believe that for Cronenberg, this was about death, you know, and so there's that decomposition, et cetera, that also comes along with it. Very morbid, actually.
Very morbid. And, you know, like how devoted Gina Davis's character is to this man that she loves. There's that one really disgusting moment where his ear falls off and she goes in to hug him. And she hugs him on the side where his ear had fallen off. And she said that when she watched it in a theater, there were, for 10 minutes straight, people were just like, oh, because she had gone and hugged him on that side. And it was,
I know, that was a really brave moment for her character to go and give him that hug.
But the behind the scenes stuff that I watched of these prosthetics and this, you know, like there are hours and hours and hours of like looking at puppets and, you know, failing and trying and adding more goop, you know, constantly adding more goop. Everyone who was working on special effects was just like, we knew this was going to be wet because it's David Cronenberg. Everything is wet.
Yeah.
Whether it's blood or goop or whatever. And I'm thinking, you know, like that's something where, okay, great. I'm glad that Stuart Kornfeld had read this and was just like, okay, I'm ready to take this on when there's going to be tons of rigs and puppets and a gimbal that's going to have to like take 4 days to make, but be on screen for 30 seconds. You know, these are things that a producer has to think about when they're reading a script. And I was wondering if you had any point in your life, you know, looked at a script and said like, oh, this is going to be an expensive thing to make, you know. Do we do this? Is this worth the risk?
I mean, definitely there's been scripts that I've read that my company has not been able to make because of the cost. In terms of some scenes, I remember on Divergent, I mean, there's a lot of major crowd scenes and a lot of action in that film. But I very, very starkly remember a scene with a stunt performer who is rigged up and has to jump down multiple levels.
Yeah.
And land on a mat. And this is a pivotal moment in the movie for Shailene Woodley's character, who, you know, is basically leaving her world and entering into this world where she is becoming a warrior.
Yeah.
It was pretty, as a producer, quite nerve-wracking. watching. So you're sitting there and just like, okay, I'm going to watch this happen. And we had the best, you know, stunt coordinator, and it was all great, but it was a little bit upsetting to observe.
You're like, wow, this whole movie hinges on this being good. Like, what's your role like on a day-to-day thing on set? I think people would be curious to know, you know, what you are, like how often you're on set, how close you are working towards it.
Yeah, it depends. You know, as a financier producer, there's, you know, sometimes we're financing and co-producing mm-hmm. with another producing team, and they're much more on the ground. Other times we're the lead producer and we're, you know, lockstep with the director and all in and, you know, really, really living, breathing, eating everything on the film. So it there's varying levels of how much you're lifting and not lifting.
Well, so you've risen, you're, you know, you're chief creative officer now at this point. So does that mean that you have to spend more time away from sets? Does that mean you have to be on set more? Or
yeah, I mean, I have a balance. So I'm never really going to go away for an entire movie and just be the sole producer on a set, because I'm, you know, have a slate and I'm running this company alongside my COO, Adrian Alperovich, who's mm-hmm. my partner. So I'm never going to be there 24/7. But yeah. I like to be there a lot, and I will go back and forth and we'll travel, you know, every other week or something like that, and then just work remotely.
So, I mean, you do have to keep at least an eye on it, on like look at dailies.
Yeah.
Often do you guys look at dailies?
Oh, daily.
Daily? Daily?
You know, I'll go through dailies, you know, on a daily basis, and I'll be on set a lot. I like to be there, and you get the granular issues of what's going on. You get to know everybody, all the players, and you can have a real influence in the storytelling. You know, obviously, if things are running incredibly smoothly and there aren't any problems, mm-hmm. there's no need, you know,
yeah.
to be there so frequently if there's another producer on set.
Have there been any points where that you remember where you were able to kind of problem solve or influence the story from your position?
Yeah, you know, sometimes actors or directors will have ideas in the moment that'll kind of move a scene away from the bigger picture. And so in the moment, the specifics make sense. But sometimes they're so in the moment, they forget about kind of like the time and place and kind of the overarching arc of the character's journey or of the movie itself. So, you know, I've been in situations where I've been able to just kind of like peel it back and be like, you know, if you go down that path, you're going to paint yourself in this corner and you don't want to go there. And then that's, you know, agreed upon by everybody.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's daily issues that come up. And, you know, I remember, again, back on Divergent, there was a massive, it was actually a tornado that was coming towards Chicago. Yeah, it was. And it didn't become an actual tornado, but the winds were so massive. So we had to make calls as to, like, you know, we're in the middle of shooting. Like, what do? Do we shut down? Like, where do we go?
Yeah.
Who goes where? Do we let people go home? Do we try to find, you know, shelter here? So you know, natural circumstances are also something that in terms of just a problem-solving thing, can impact what you're actually shooting in that moment.
Yeah, if only you could figure out how to control the weather.
Yeah, that'd be nice. That'd be good.
One of the things that John Getz has said, like, we're gonna wrap this up, but John Getz, his leg, his foot, does get kind of, not severed, it's separated from his body because of the acid, right?
Yeah.
So they have this kind of prosthetic foot that they had for the production, and he was allowed to keep it and take it home, and he kept it in his refrigerator for like 10 years, like in his freezer. And the neighborhood kids in Brooklyn would come over and ask him, like, at least once a week, hey, can we see your foot? And it was like a fun thing for him to take out the foot and show these kids. And that was his memento. And he had a really, he didn't even want to work on the movie. But David Cronenberg's like, no, you're so grumpy. I have to have you. And so he did. And then he loved it. And he took this foot home. And it was a great experience for him. But I, you know, just wrapping this up, was there, do you have any mementos from productions that you worked on that you cherish or things that you wish you could have taken?
There are definitely things I wish I could have taken. I wanted to steal the little stuffed Stuart Little mouse that we used instead when we weren't using the ball, the green ball visual effects.
Yeah.
Because that would have been a fun little thing to have around my house. But I did not steal that object. But I do not have the foot in my freezer.
If only.
If only I did.
Rachel, thank you so much for coming and talking with us today about your work and about The Fly. Do you have anything that you wanted to plug coming out?
The next season of Genius airs today in the United States and soon globally. And it's the story of Picasso and his life and the women in his life. So please go see it. It's on Nat Geo.
I love hearing about behind the scenes stuff. And I think our listeners love hearing what producers do on set because you guys are sometimes the unsung heroes of movie making.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. Next week, we'll be talking to Sarah Gamble, the creator of Sci-Fi Channel's The Magicians, and we will be discussing Being John Malkovich. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. A Snyderist. Yeah, A Snyderist. I identify as female and crave female-led genre in all things. This feeds that need and my new need interest in directing film. Thank you for opening a door and then leaving it open for us newcomers. It pushes me to continue forward this new world of film directing. Yay! This is like a little mini film school for you. Fun school. Ian Mascara says, Switchblade Sisters gives a voice to women who make the films we love to share the films they love. As a scholar of critical media studies, I usually talk about movies in the context of their cultural impact. When I listen to Switchblade, I get to hear about the craft of filmmaking in a way that I don't often get to experience in my daily life. Do yourself a favor and check it out. Thank you guys so much. We really appreciate it. And if you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group as well, facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.